Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
It was plain as the nose on just about any thinking person's face. Reza Aslan, a thinking person par excellence, makes this all the more confoundingly clear as he explains in his new book, How to Win a Cosmic War, Globalization and the End of the War on Terror. Dr. Reza Aslan, an internationally acclaimed writer and scholar of religions, is a columnist at the Daily Beast. He holds degrees in religions from Santa Clara University, Harvard University, and UC Santa Barbara, as well as a Master's of Fine Arts from the University of Iowa, where he was named the Truman Capote Fellow in Fiction. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities, and the Pacific Council on International Policy. He serves on the board of directors for both the Plowshares Fund, which gives grants for peace and security issues, Abraham's Vision and Interfaith Peace Organization, and Penn USA. Aslan's first book is the New York Times bestseller, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, which has been translated into 13 languages, shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award in the UK, and nominated for a Penn USA Award for Research Nonfiction. His most recent book, which is on sale in the lobby after the program, is followed by an edited anthology, which is going to be out in 2010, Words Without Borders, Writings from the Middle East. Aslan is co-founder and chief creative officer of BoomGen Studios, a hub for creative content from and about the Middle East, as well as editorial executive of Mecca.com. Born in Iran, he now lives in Los Angeles, where he is assistant professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. In conversation with Dr. Aslan this evening is Amy Willentz, author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, Martyrs Crossing, and I Feel Earthquakes More Often Than They Happen, Coming to California in the Age of Schwarzenegger. That's right. She is the winner of the Whiting Writers Award, the Penn Martha Albrand Nonfiction Award, and the American Academy of Arts and Letters Rosenthal Award, and also a 1990 nominee for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Amy has written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Time Magazine, The New Republic, Mother Jones, Harper's Vogue, Condé Nast Traveler, Travel and Leisure, The San Francisco Chronicle, More, The Village Voice, The London Review of Books, and many other publications. She is the former Jerusalem correspondent of The New Yorker and a longtime contributing editor at The Nation. She teaches in the literary journalism program at UC Irvine and lives in Los Angeles with her husband and three sons. This evening's program will conclude with an audience Q&A. We'll have a microphone going around, actually two of them. Please wait for it to get to you because we want to hear what you're saying and because we record for podcast. After the program, Reza and Amy will both be signing in the lobby. Proceeds from the book sales go to support the Los Angeles Public Library. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in turning off your cell phones and in welcoming Reza Aslan and Amy Willentz to the Los Angeles Central Library.
Hi, everybody.
Hello. So I always have to carry books around or I don't feel comfortable.
I noticed you brought your purse out, too, which is...
Well, they said not to leave anything of value in there, and I felt, to me, it's valuable, although to others it probably won't. Okay. So Reza's new book is about the idea of a cosmic war, and I want to get him to talk about that at first, and then we'll talk about some other things and have, we hope, a freewheeling conversation today. So in the new book, you cite the famous writer about war, Sun Tzu, And you quote him as saying, if you do not know who the enemy is, you cannot win the war. And you rightly say that the word terrorist has become a kind of wastebasket word as it's used by the advocates of the endless war on terror. So we're not at war with all terrorists, as you point out. The Basque ETA is not really our big enemy, and neither are the Tamil Tigers. Can you define for us today, tonight, the kind of terrorist, or what is the idea of the terrorist with whom we believe we are at war?
Right. Thank you. That's a great question. I just want to begin by saying that, first of all, thank you all for coming. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm glad you're here, too.
But I'm especially delighted to be here with Amy Wilentz, whom I've been a huge fan of for many, many years. I think your Haiti book is incredible. People buy this book on Haiti, seriously. And love your work from the Middle East. And thank you so much for being
here
and doing this. So what was the question? No, I'm just kidding.
Something about terror. Fun topic.
Well, look, this is the issue, is that, you know, the war on terror is not a war on terror per se. It's a war on a particular kind of terror that employed solely by Muslim entities, which explains in some ways why, you know, this whole conflict, or the enemy, I should say, in this conflict, has systematically and gradually expanded to include not just al-Qaeda and the various militant organizations that associate with the global jihadist movement, but also a whole host of disparate organizations and movements and non-state entities and state actors, from, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah to, you know, the Chechen rebels to, you know, the Iranian government to the various Sunni insurgents in Iraq. And apparently, you know, the sort of master narrative of the war on terror as it was written by the previous administration was that this represents some kind of monolithic force, you know, with an identical agenda and a similar ideology, when in fact nothing could be further from the truth. And by the way, we have to give it a good name, right? So we'll call it, I don't know, Islamofascism, which is absurd, which is a completely nonsensical term. When the truth of the matter is that what we're dealing with is a whole host of disparate groups and organizations and different ideologies and agendas, some nationally oriented, some globally oriented, many of whom hate each other much more than they hate us. But what we did is, by lumping all of these groups into a single category, enemy, and then giving it a single label, terrorist, and then responding with a single reaction, war, we not only created this undifferentiated enemy that I was talking about in the passage that you cited, but we have essentially given fodder to the argument that the war on terror is in fact a war on Islam. There's a very real reason why two-thirds of the Muslim world believe that the war on terror is actually a war on Islam, because that's what it is.
And it was framed that way.
Yeah, basically. That's exactly how it was framed, and consciously so.
Yet you talk in the book about the cosmic war and the idea that there is, in fact, a kind of global jihadism that is very consciously being fomented, is maybe the wrong word, but encouraged by al-Qaeda, among others. That is not so much an Islam of nationalism, but an Islam of identity.
Right. So, you know, if you have to step back for a moment and say, okay, well, then who is the enemy then? Okay, if it's not this sort of monolithic, imaginary, you know, force that we've created, who is the enemy? Well, the proper answer to that question is essentially, well, the people who are responsible for the attacks of 9/11 and the organization that sort of buttresses those militants. And that idea, you know, this sort of what I refer to as the global jihadist movement, is very unique, because what they are engaged in is what I refer to as a cosmic war, a war of the imagination.
Right.
They're fighting a conflict that may be taking place on Earth, but is in fact in their minds nothing more than just a shadow of a larger conflict between the cosmic forces of good and evil, and that what's at stake for them is not any material value. values whatsoever. They're not fighting a political war. They have no interest in territorial gains of any kind. They're certainly not interested in the creation of any kind of nation state. Quite the contrary, their ultimate goal is to get rid of all nation states, to erase all borders and boundaries, and to reconstitute the globe as a single world order under their rulership, what they refer to as a caliphate.
But what's so weird when I hear you talking about this, except for the word caliphate, it sounds like a little bit of George Bush's plan, too. A cosmic war between good and evil, and you make those points,
there
of course,
you go.
In the book.
Yeah. You know, this is an organization that's not fighting a war that can be won in any real or measurable terms. They're engaged in a conflict in which God is actively involved. They see themselves as nothing more than just pawns in the hands of God, or actors in a divine script that was written at the beginning of time. They are in a physical battle against, you know, the American troops or American forces or what have you, but the war itself is being waged on another plane. And as you say, yes, the Bush administration, by very consciously and deliberately adopting the same religiously polarizing language, by accepting the same cosmic worldview, transformed this so-called war on terror into a cosmic war. And as I say in the book, you know, the problem with a cosmic war is you can't win a cosmic war.
And you can never judge whether you've won it.
Right, well, because what's at stake is you know, not one's own sense of self. You know, the way that you win this conflict is by, well, to quote George Bush, ridding the world of evil.
Right.
That's what Bush said was the ultimate goal of the war on terror. Really? Really? Ridding the world of evil?
And you talk interestingly about how the first word out of his mouth, and reflexively, not even scripted, was crusade.
Yes,
so
this
he
is
responded.
The famous crusade speech.
It almost as if 9/11 spoke to his very heart.
Interestingly, you know, I find it, I think most Americans kind of forgave him for that crusade speech because they thought it was a flub. It was not a flub.
Well, and they think of it as something, you know, oh, well, it's a crusade for helping children at the children's hospital
right.
downtown, because we use it that way in English, but that's not how it's heard.
And that's actually precisely what Bush's advisors said. You know, they sort of stumbled over themselves to be like, no, 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 he didn't mean crusade, as in, you know, military battles. You know, fought by Christian knights against Muslims. No, what he meant was crusade as in crusade against evildoers. That's what he that's what he really meant. But the fact of the matter is that the very first time that the phrase war on terrorism was ever used, the first time that it was brought into our cultural lexicon, it was clearly defined as a crusade. This Bush's exact words on September 12th was this crusade, pause, this war on terrorism, pause, will take a while. So from the very first moment in which the concept of a war on terrorism was brought out, it was infused with this cosmic sort of worldview, this sort of evangelizing spirit. And as I say, you know, it doesn't help matters that the word crusade is actually translated into Arabic as Khurub al-Salib, or the Wars of the Cross. And so the Arab press reported Bush's comments the day after September 11th as saying, this war of the cross, this war on terrorism, you know, will take a while. And what I wanted to sort of emphasize is that, you know, maybe this was sort of a slip up or a flub or whatever, but the fact of the matter is that this is truly how Bush thought, and more importantly, he essentially gave voice to the sentiments of a very large, large proportion of Americans who were already brimming with religious fury and were looking for precisely this kind of apocalyptic and cosmic framework to understand this coming conflict with jihadism, and Bush provided it.
One thing you say in the book is that the way to win a cosmic war is simply not to engage in it, not to respond to those who are waging the war.
Now nobody's going to buy it.
Well, you know, it's kind of problematic.
All right, no, I'm just kidding.
But so what do you do with September 11th? Do you not respond? I mean, what is the thing you do?
Yeah, so the argument of the book is that Yeah, the way that you win a cosmic war is by refusing to fight in one. And so what we really need to do is we need to bring this conflict back down to Earth by addressing the very real material grievances that fuel this cosmic impulse, and by not validating the worldview of these militants by saying, yeah, you're right, it is a war between good and evil. It's just that we're good and you're evil.
You've got it wrong.
Yeah, it's just
the
opposite.
We're the good ones.
because, of course, that just legitimizes their worldview, and more importantly, it turns them into soldiers. This is the other issue about the whole concept of the metaphor of war. Is war the proper metaphor to think about the conflict with Al-Qaeda? Because if you declare war on a terrorist organization, they're not terrorists anymore. That's it. Whatever they, you can no longer describe their actions as terrorism because you've declared war on them. They're now soldiers, and anything goes. So, you know, in that regard, we can talk about whether that's the proper response anyway. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, we're dealing with a criminal conspiracy, and it's one that sort of requires proper intelligence and police work to bring to justice. But to throw this framework of war upon this group is to elevate it to a level that it just simply, you know, didn't exist.
And to engage tons of forces that otherwise might not have been engaged.
Yeah, and to bring other actors into the conflict that had nothing to do with it. You know, by saying you're either with us or you're with the terrorists, which was Bush's September 14th speech, that's it. His exact words, there in this conflict, there is no middle ground. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. Well, for a great many in the Muslim world, you know, that's a pretty easy decision to make because they're not with us. They may not be with the terrorists, but you're essentially pushing them off this ledge. By the way, when bin Laden was told by an Al Jazeera reporter of that speech, he said, he took the words right out of my mouth.
Ah, that's such a great quote.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk for a sec about young men. Young men are very close to my heart because I am mother of three young men. And according to Reza's book, which has a lot of great quotes from bin Laden, he's eminently quotable.
He really, I have to say, you know, he's an odious megalomaniac and mass murderer, but man, he can talk.
He says, bin Laden says, like a real marketing executive, he says that his message is targeted at 15 to 25-year-olds, which is...
Solely for 15 to 25-year-olds is what he says.
Men,
yeah.
Of course, which is basically where my boys are. And I've always had this theory that what you should do with boys, and it's especially coming true now, 15 to say, well, I expand on bin Laden's target group to 35. I say... Take them and put them in prison and just keep them there. Not mean, be nice, but and let them out when they're 35 and you won't have so much trouble, no car crashes, no violence, nothing. But I realized, you know, I think it's funny and it certainly resonates in my house, but the real problem with that is then there would be no agents for change. So I wonder how you feel about this. You've really talked to people who were involved. Reza interviewed people who were peripheral to the London bombings on July 7th. He's talked to this young men group, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that I think is important to understand about jihadism, is that it's a youth movement. It's deliberately designed as a youth movement. What makes it appealing is that it's a deeply anti-institutional, anti-authoritative movement. It thrives. In fact, its very identity is formed in direct opposition to the traditional leaders of the Arab and Muslim world, the traditional ulema or the religious leaders and the political leaders. It takes upon itself the rights and the privileges that have for 14 centuries been reserved solely for a very high level of clerical scholar in Islam. And so that's why someone like bin Laden, you know, constantly issues these fatwas. This is a man who hasn't had a day of religious instruction in his life. And a fatwa, you know, a fatwa is nothing but a sort of legal ruling. It's a juristic opinion. But, you know, you have to go through decades of authoritative study in one of a very few handfuls of official institutions in the Islamic world before you're allowed to actually issue fatwas. It'd be like, you know, if some like a Catholic youth pastor goes around issuing papal bulls. It just doesn't make any sense. But bin Laden does this precisely because he's co-opting that authority, and he's giving that authority to all these young individuals who, by the way, already feel sort of disenfranchised. They don't go to mosque. This is the other big issue, is that, you know, in the West we think that somehow mosques are the center of radicalism. The exact opposite is true. The mosques is where these people avoid, because they don't find anything for them, you know, in the traditional conservative sense of the religion. They're highly educated, they're politically active, they're globally engaged, they're socially conscious, they're desperate for a version of Islam that speaks to the needs and the aspirations and the activism of a 16, you know, year old, of a 19-year-old. If this were, you know, 40 years ago, we'd call them socialists. If this was, you know, 60 years ago, we'd call them communists. If this were 80 years ago, we'd call them anarchists. It's just now we call them jihadists. It's the new form of reactionary identity. And as a result, it's geared toward precisely the kind of people who are interested in such utopian ideas as global transformation. You know, I mean, who has time to think about these kinds of things? Not poor people, not the young man living on a pile of rubble that used to be his house in Gaza. No, it's the second generation, well-educated British kid living in London. You know, who has time to think of such concerns?
Right. Although the guy living on rubble in Gaza is also thinking somewhat similar thoughts.
Well, what he's thinking of is much more nationalist concerns.
Right.
He's acting on an issue of
talk about the far enemy and the near enemy.
That's right. Yeah. So this is sort of the larger issue that the jihadists talk about a lot. This concept of a far and a near enemy. The near enemy in the jihadist mindset are essentially other Muslims. The religious and political institutions, those Muslim groups that don't agree with their particularly puritanical brand.
The Saudi monarchy.
The Saudi monarchy, definitely. Although the Saudi monarchy, they're sort of everyone's enemies, except for the Hummer driver. The Hummer driver loves the Saudi monarchy, but the far enemy, of course, is us, you know, the West, the United States, you know. And there is this sort of constant back and forth in the jihadist circles about, you know, where the focus should be, whether we should be fighting, you know, our own local governments and our own, you know, religious institutions, or whether we should, you know, fight the West. Al-Qaeda, what we now refer to as Al-Qaeda, came about as a direct result of this argument, and this very sort of really ingenious decision on their part that, you know, when we kill other Muslims, Muslims tend to turn away from us. But what if we kill Americans and then we can sort of drag them into this fight and then use them as this polarizing, you know, symbol and get people on our side? Which is exactly how the steps towards 9/11 happened. I mean, that was very much the conscious thinking. But the real division here, if I may, just for a moment, is not between so much far enemy, near enemy concerns, but between what we call jihadism and what we call Islamism. And these two terms have become so muddled, you know, because
in the
of the
American
way,
mind,
yeah,
certainly.
The way that we use them almost interchangeably, but they mean exactly the opposite things. As I sort of alluded to earlier, Islamism is a political philosophy. It's essentially an Islamic version of religious nationalism, the same kind of religious nationalism that we have in spades here among the evangelical community in the United States, the same kind of religious nationalism that is ascending in Israel, the Jewish version of it and the Christian version here. This is just the Islamic version of it. a religious nationalist like Hamas, like Hezbollah, has very concrete goals and agendas. They want to create an Islamic state, whatever that means, based on an Islamic moral framework, whatever that means. And I say this because it's important to understand that while Islamism means something very specific, it means, you know, nationalism, it comes in all kinds of varieties. You know, there are Islamist groups who want to create a state through revolution and violence. There are Islamist groups that are happy to do so through, you know, the political process and, in fact, through democracy. I often say that if one term, Islamism, adequately describes both the Taliban, the most draconian, you know, movement in modern memory, and the Justice and Development Party in Turkey, the ruling party in Turkey that has brought more democracy to that country than it has ever experienced, that has brought greater freedoms of religion and speech, that has brought Turkey closer to Israel and to Europe and to the United States than it has ever been, and that has proceeded over 7 consecutive years of record economic growth. If you can call both the Taliban and the Justice and Development Party Islamist parties, that word is useless. But we use it because it does mean something very specific. A jihadist is the exact opposite of an Islamist. Not only is this a transnational movement, it's an anti-national movement. Jihadism views the very concept of the nation state as anathema to Islam. They want to get rid of all nationalities, all cultures, all ethnicities, and return the globe, as I said, to this sort of purified, unadulterated, you know, singular past. They're truly globalists.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's
the other side of globalization, really.
It is the other side. And what's shocking is, and the reason why, you know, if there were an epicenter to jihadism, it's not in the Middle East, it's in Europe. That's really sort of where jihadism as a social movement is thriving. But it kind of makes sense if you think about it, because the borderless world that the jihadists imagine already exists. It's called the EU. You know, this idea they're living in it. You know, 27 nation states, 13 languages, all united by a single constitution, a single birth certificate, a single passport, a single currency, you know, a single parliament, in which, you know, your national identity is deliberately supposed to take a back seat to this sort of transnational alliance. This is the caliphate.
Yet,
this is the caliphate.
The biggest fear on the part of all of those Europeans, or a very present fear, is that they are becoming Islamified and that the Muslim population is somehow taking over, even though you point out that it's only like 6% tops,
it's 4%,
right?
4% of the entire continent of Europe is Muslim. Demographers believe that that number will absolutely top at 6%.
Yet and in France, you would think that it was 25%.
Right.
I've had French people say to me, well, it's done.
Yeah.
What can we do? So now we have to figure out what we do.
Yeah, yeah.
They ban the veil.
Well, and you know, it makes fodder for some great best-selling books, right? Our own Tony Blankley. Yeah.
Is he mine?
Yes, well, you know, I guess he's not. But he wrote this, you know, piece of claptrap called While Europe Slept, in which he said that the threat of Muslims taking over Europe is every bit as real and dangerous as the threat of the Nazis in the 1940s. The idiocy of that statement is beyond, you know, understanding. I mean, I just don't. I mean, first of all, let's just all agree that we're going to stop comparing things to the Nazis.
But it's so much fun.
Can we, you know?
Can I just make a comparison? Can I make a comparison?
Does it involve Hitler or the Nazis?
Hitler and the Nazis. Okay, Hitler had a plan and an agenda when he was trying to take over Europe. But when, I mean, there may have been certain fluid goals that Al-Qaeda had, but what they wanted to do, they didn't have a demand.
They were not
making a demand when they knocked down the World Trade Center. They were making, as you say, a symbolic
statement. That's right.
And you see a lot of that with the kind of terror that is inflicted by these movements.
This, I think, the hardest thing for an American audience to understand is that Al-Qaeda doesn't want anything. That's the hardest thing to understand. They have no goals. They have no policies. They have no social agenda. They have, you know, no sort of, you know, they are utopian in the real true sense of that word. Their idea is, look, we'll just destroy this world order and then a new world order will arise and then we'll deal with it then.
Right. That's it wasn't like knock it down and then go in and like take over downtown New York.
There is no plan. There is no plan in place. And strangely, that's what makes it so appealing, particularly the young people.
Of course. That knock it down was the theme of my children when they
were You know, the idea is that this is a movement that's unsullied by such material concerns as strategy, you know. That there's something pure about this movement, and that's why it's so appealing. And truly, I mean, that's the whole sort of purpose of terrorism, right? It's to provide the illusion of power. It's not as though those 19 men who brought those towers down thought, oh, well, now there'll be peace in Palestine.
Right, no,
not
at all.
No, of course, it was the furthest thing from their minds. You know, this was an attempt to create a very real theatrical display of violence whose sole purpose was to provide the illusion of power. And that's precisely what it did. It worked brilliantly.
Very satisfying. Yeah. I wanted to sort of go off topic for a minute and tell you all that Rez is kind of a sham.
It's true.
Well, you know, I met him like 5 years ago and I thought, oh, great, my Middle Eastern friend. And then I open up this book and the new book, the Cosmic War book, and I find out secretly, no, okay, he's born in Iran. That's something, I guess. But when he was 7, he moved to Oklahoma. So he's an Okie. And I assume you're proud to be an Okie, correct?
That's right, that's right.
You have to be proud to be an Okie.
Proud
but
to be an Okie.
I have a question for you, which is, born in Iran, lived in Oklahoma, how do you end up being here and at this point and having made the decisions you've made as a pointy-headed intellectual?
You know, I don't know. It's funny. I've actually asked my parents this question, like, Oklahoma, really? Enid, and not just
Enid,
Oklahoma.
Enid, Oklahoma.
Which
Is there a big community there?
No.
No.
No, no, no. I couldn't find it on a map.
They just
honestly
went like this.
I think they've given me different answers. I think ultimately the reason is they thought it was America.
Mm. And turns the out real America.
Turns out they were right.
Yeah.
But you know, we were there for about a year when it became very clear that there are other places. You know, like heading westward, and that's truly what we did. We got into the car and headed west. And
yet you use Enid, Oklahoma,
well,
in your biography.
Yes, because
I accuse you of shameless manipulation.
Well, because you know, one of the things that I'm trying to talk about in this book is this idea of identity, because that is how jihadism works. It's an, as I said, it's an alternative identity. It functions particularly well in Europe because there is a deep identity vacuum in Europe, particularly amongst these first, second generation immigrants who are primarily, you know, forced into these ethnic enclaves. In many countries in Europe, they're not given an opportunity to become a part of society, to become real citizens. Their, you know, citizenship laws in parts of Europe are so weird. And
learn Danish, and then you can be a citizen.
Or in Germany. I mean, in Germany, until quite recently, you could be born in Germany. Your father could have been born in Germany. Your grandfather could have been born in Germany. But if you're Turkish, you're not German.
I love
you're
that quote you
Turkish.
Have from some German, some official who says, there is no way to become German.
You just
are.
You just are. Yeah.
That's a voice I recognize, you know,
that was
from
the question.
My ethnic
are.
Past.
Well, now imagine giving that choice to, you know, the immigrant or to the child of an immigrant. There is no mechanism for you to become German. You will accept you as a national, we'll even accept you as a
effectively
citizen.
Effectively stateless.
But you're always a Turk.
Right? Effectively
you're
stateless
always
forever.
Algerian. Right. Exactly. And it's that vacuum of identity that jihadism sort of steps into. So I deal a lot with identity in this book, and one of the things that I talk about is that when I was in Iran, when I lived in Iran, you could dress American, you could speak American, you could act American, you could eat American, and everybody knew exactly what that meant. American was something that you became, whereas Iranian was something that you were. And coming to the United States, that lesson was really brought home to me when I became a citizen. Because, as I say in the book, I was sitting in this, you know, this sort of the IRS office, which is the worst place on earth. I mean, you know, it's like you ever want to be treated like cattle.
We never want to go there. IRS.
Yeah. Right. And the woman is giving me my citizenship exam, which, I mean, I see some faces in this room that look like they may have taken a citizenship exam. You know how crazy and ridiculous it is. They ask you these, you know, like, who said give me liberty or give me death? Okay, now you can be American. When the exam was over, she, you know, without looking up from her paper, just said, what do you want your new name to be? And I thought, what? What are you talking about? Is your new name? What do you want your new name to be? And honestly, like thinking back at it, what shocked me wasn't the sort of abruptness of the question. It was the assumption embedded in the question, which was, this is more than citizenship. This is conversion. You know, this is. It's almost like
a new you.
It's a new you. You're taking on a new identity. What do you want your name to be?
Whereas in Germany, again, there's a list of names, and you can only have those names in Germany.
And you're very smart to get those names, because if you want an apartment
right.
or a job,
Mohammed's
you
not
need,
the best name.
No, it's not the right name if you want, yeah. So, you know, I talk a lot about the difference between the United States and Europe, and, you know, what we talk about when we talk about integration. When Europe says integrate, what they mean is stop being you and start being us. That's what that means. But that's not what we talk about here in the United States. You know, we're often referred to as a melting pot. I don't like that phrase. We're more like a sponge. We just sort of absorb, you know, the cultures and the ethnicities and the languages and the identities, and we just constantly rewrite the narrative, our national narrative, depending on, you know, who's the newest group that arrives on our
shores.
But
one thing is, if you say stop being you and start being us, but you can't have the same rights. That's a big problem.
Whereas
in America, you could say, stop being you, start being us. But once you're us, then you have a full-fledged set of civil rights.
Yeah. The very notion that you have to work for your citizenship is something strange for us, too. I mean, if your nine-month-old mother could sort of, you know, take a step over across the border and plop you out, you're as American as Thomas Jefferson at that point. So for us, it's so bizarre to think that you could be, you know, three
generations
in a country and you're still not a citizen. How is that possible?
Let's go back a little bit in history. One of the really amusing and revealing things about this book is how it goes into religious history. And that happens to be one of Reza's areas of expertise. In fact, his real area of expertise. And one of the best and most telling stories, I thought, was the one about Ahmed ibn Taymiyyah. Is that how you
Taymiyyah.
Say it?
Taymiyyah, yeah, Taymiyyah.
He's the sheikh who preached the doctrines of takfir in the wake of Genghis Khan's destruction of the old Islamic world when it was taken over by the Mongol horde, as it's called. And he seems so relevant to this whole idea of the global jihadist identity. And
in fact, he's sort of like the grandfather.
So if you could explain what takfir is, which is related to some of the things you were talking about
earlier. This principle of takfir, it started with Ibn Taymiyyah in about the 12th, 13th century, and then it just sort of went away for a while, and the global jihadist movement has resurrected it. Yeah, and you have to understand that in Islam, there is no such thing as sort of excommunication. Like there is no single body in Islam that can define who is and who is not a Muslim. There's no Muslim Pope. There's no Muslim Vatican. The creedal formula in Islam is two sentences long. There is no God but God. Muhammad is God's messenger. That's it. After that, you know, it's all a matter of sort of the practices, the rituals that kind of make you a part of this community of faith, but there's no sort of complex, you know, recipe of faith to follow, so that if you don't follow a part of that, then some, you know, person in a robe somewhere can simply say, you're not part of this group anymore. That doesn't happen, which is, by the way, why, despite common perception in the West, Islam is unquestionably the most diverse, the most eclectic religion in the history of the world, because it has no center to it. There is no sort of organizing principle to it. And so as a result, there is no way to say who is and who is not a Muslim. And this is an argument that's been had for 14 centuries, particularly amongst puritanical groups who feel like, well, we're doing the right Islam and you're doing the wrong Islam. And
it sounds like Jews, I have to say.
Right. It's very much the same, orthopraxic religions. And so this concept arose in the 13th century called takfir, which is best described as essentially excommunication. It's the unilateral declaration by one individual against another individual that that person is no longer a Muslim. There is no doctrinal sort of backing to this. There's no legal backing to this. It's not in the Quran. It doesn't really
exist.
And
it's been rejected.
Oh, yes, it's widely rejected. I mean, you could understand the problems with it. But there is this legal code in Islam that says that you're not allowed to kill another Muslim. I mean, it's very clear in the Quran. And so how do you get away with that? You use takfir. You just simply unilaterally announce a person to no longer be a Muslim, and that allows you now to then kill them.
Was that declared in the World Trade Center when Muslims died?
That was a sort of a much more complex argument that was made about the idea of democracy. The issue is that in a democracy, there's no such thing as combatant and non-combatant. If you voted for this government,
you're a combatant.
You're a combatant, yeah. And they didn't realize, you know, they weren't paying attention in the year 2000, apparently. They weren't part of the Florida recount. But Al-Qaeda and these jihadists use this tool of takfir to engage in this just appalling bloodletting of other Muslims. And particularly in Iraq, this was used with great skill against the Shia, who have always been considered, you know, the questionable cousins. Right, exactly. You know, the heretic community within the larger Sunni community. And you just sort of declare whole swaths of people as not really Muslim
and thus
therefore apostate and therefore
targets.
And therefore legitimate targets. You could shed their blood.
It's kind of convenient.
It is kind of convenient. And there's been, you know, the sort of clerical authorities have gone through great lengths to sort of fight back against this. There was in 2005, a very famous document called the Amman Declaration, right, in which 170 of the world's leading scholars and clerics in Islam, representing every single sect and schism and institution, which in and of itself is shocking. I mean, imagine if, like, you know, leaders of every Protestant, you know, denomination.
It will never happen.
Could even get into the same room, exactly, let alone like issue a statement of mutual concern. Issued a statement. They actually issued three statements. The first was denouncing violence in the name of Islam in all forms, and in fact calling it a sin to even emotionally support violence in Islam. The second one was deliberately about this takfir. It was sort of a reminder once more that there is no such thing as takfir. You cannot unilaterally declare someone to not be a Muslim, that this practice doesn't exist. The third fatwa was my favorite fatwa, and it was a fatwa reminding the Muslim world that they're the only ones allowed to issue a fatwa.
That's the problem.
Just a reminder, people, we're the only ones who can do this.
But that's why the other is so attractive to everyone on the outside.
Well, this is what I thought was brilliant about Al-Qaeda's response, is that they issued a fatwa declaring everyone who took part in the conference as a takfir.
They are so cool. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it seems so medieval, these discussions about that are so important, yet they are about basically religious law.
They are, but we do have to recognize that this is an argument that the jihadists are not interested in having. You see, as a deeply anti-institutional movement, they have no concern with legal or religious issues. They are actually, when it comes to religion, quite illiterate. These are kids who can't speak Arabic. They don't read the Quran. They have no conception of Islamic law or theology. They are not interested in anyone who shows any sign of formal training.
Right.
They find that very suspicious. They're interested in sort of gurus, you know, self-styled gurus. It's a deeply, deeply individualistic movement, which is why it sort of has within it the seeds of its own destruction. You all might remember about a week ago there was an article on the front page of the New York Times about this ideologue, this Al-Qaeda ideologue named al-Maqdisi, who had issued this tirade on the internet. And he's old time. I mean, he's one of the old ones. I mean, he was like Abdullah Azzam's friend. He was the mentor to Zarqawi. I mean, he was sort of like, he was there before, you know, bin Laden. I mean, the sort of one of the sort of founders of this movement. And he was complaining that nobody takes him seriously anymore in the jihadist movement, that they've all the young people have ignored him and they've pushed him aside. And what was fascinating is that he was referencing all of this material done by the intelligence community in the United States.
That's how he found out?
No, he was saying, look at the Americans know how important I am. All they do is talk about me.
And yet you reject
them. There are dissertations written about me in America. You know, and he was actually naming scholars and people and websites that have quoted his writings and, you know, and arguing to, you know, his fellow jihadists, you know, take me seriously again. And the response from these kids is, you know, go away, grandpa.
Right.
That's the response, you know. It has within it, it's so deeply anti-institutional and so anti-authoritative that it has its own, the seeds of destruction are
well,
embedded within
what
it.
You're reminding me of is I remember talking to David Grossman, the Israeli novelist, about the tactic of suicide bombing and why it was so counterproductive for the Palestinians. And he was saying how one of the biggest problems with a tactic like that is if you encourage it in your movement and you encourage it against the enemy, eventually, one day, it will be used by your people against you.
Which is exactly what's
happened. And I think
that's
what you're seeing there.
That's exactly what's happened. It's become a tool for an internal conflict.
Right. It's scary. One other thing I wanted to talk about before we begin to talk to the audience, which we really want to do and which we like to do. I wrote in my novel a little bit about this idea of the innocent enemy. The novel takes place, there's a kid who's at the center of a problem between Palestinians and Israelis, and it's tragic. And the really hard-wing, hard-line Palestinian begins to think about this idea of the baby and the innocent enemy. And do you think that there is any concept like that among jihadists?
No.
There can't be, right?
There is a concept like that, obviously, amongst these nationalist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah. You know, we can't, again, as I said at the very beginning, we can't just sort of lump anybody that defines itself as Muslim and uses terror as a tactic in the same category and think that they all want the same thing. But no, when it comes to the jihadists, and particularly, you know, with these militant groups like Al-Qaeda, again, their war doesn't take place on this realm.
So that
and so human morality has nothing to do with it.
Because you describe this incredible scene in Iraq, I think,
yeah,
in a small town where a guy brings in a cart of candy and toys, and he actually like lifts up the top of the cart and
waits for the kids, the toys,
and they come in with their little monies, and he waits for them to get closer and closer, and then he explodes himself.
Right.
That to me.
When your framework doesn't exist on this level. When you're fighting a conflict in which God is in charge, human morality plays no role whatsoever. I mean, those kinds of ethical concerns have to be set aside. You know, there's an argument that's made a lot about how, you know, what these guys are engaging in is so profoundly un-Islamic, as though that makes a difference. You know, for them, the very concept of Islamic has a sort of earthly center to it. Exactly. It's not my gun. I'm not the one shooting this gun. God is shooting this gun. I'm not the one in charge of my actions. My actions have been predestined, you know, from the very beginning, which is, of course, the whole fear of a cosmic war and why you cannot engage in it, because there is no winning a conflict like that.
Once morality is tossed out the window, there can't be.
Precisely. All the sort of traditional boundaries between, you know, in real wars, between combatants and non-combatants and innocents and the guilty, those things break down in a cosmic war, because what you ultimately are left with is a very simple equation. If you're not us, then you're them. And if you're them, then not only are you the enemy, but you're a demonic enemy, because this isn't about, you know, nations and states and armies and soldiers.
So that
this is about good and evil.
The little babies that you see are really demon seed. And worthy of death.
If they're not with us, then they're against us. It's a very simple equation. And it's an equation that we ourselves heard very, very clearly coming out of our own administration, which again did nothing except to validate and legitimize this worldview.
So speaking of our own administration, since it's now a different administration from the one you were mostly writing about in this book, although the end of the book begins to think about what the world might look like under a new American administration, especially this one, I noticed on Twitter that you said that you thought that you were pleased with the new administration's outlook on the future in the Middle East and with terror and the war on terror, and that they had given a very good proposal, but now they should go back and write the paper. So I'm wondering, what is your opinion of
Obama?
Yeah,
you all remember because it's impossible to avoid when CNN was doing the report card. And so everybody who did CNN was like physically forced.
To use the metaphor.
To give a grade, yeah. Like if you didn't give a grade, they wouldn't let you go until you actually gave a grade. So my grade was... to the Obama administration with regard to the Muslim world was incomplete. And I said, as a professor, I can put it this way. I love the thesis statement. Now go and write the paper.
We'll see if it's any good.
Yes. And I mean that. I mean, the Obama administration has done, in one sense, the most important part, which is they've changed the framework of this argument. They have assiduously stepped away from the cosmic war. They've differentiated very clearly between all of these various movements, and they have a plan in place about who can be talked to and who can't be talked
to. So much so that Khaled Mishal of Hamas today told the New York Times that he liked the way the new administration was talking, felt it was a new discourse, and that perhaps Hamas could actually be part of the solution. Now, we can always be suspicious about what Hamas really means, but at least that's movement. Movement is good.
Well, I mean, this has changed the equation in ways that we are only now beginning to be aware of. You know, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, of course, is running for president again in Iran. He's got a very uphill battle against him. I mean, the economy's in shambles. I mean, he doesn't have a good chance of winning this thing. And so he's kind of reframed himself now as the man who can reach out to Obama. You know, the man who's going to open up, you know, he's the one who can reach out. And I kid you not that his campaign slogan is Mitavanim, which is Persian for yes, we can.
No.
I am not kidding.
He knows a winning slogan when he sees one.
I am not kidding. That's what has changed. That's what has changed. I was in Istanbul when Obama showed up. When he showed up, that in that country, Turkey, the United States had a 90% unfavorability rating, which is shocking. I mean, this is about the most secular, moderate, Western country you
can
possibly imagine. Yeah, 90% unfavorability ratings. Obama was there for 36 hours. When he left, the favorite dessert on the streets of Istanbul was baklava.
That is silly.
It was changed. I mean, it was fundamentally changed. And part of it had to do with the fact that, you know, he's someone who has sort of decided very clearly that the old clash of civilizations rhetoric, it's over. I'm not going to play that game anymore. That's a great start, because in any war of ideas, which is what we've been told repeatedly that's what this is, in any war of ideas, your words are your most effective weapons. But it's just a start. Because the fact of the matter is that there are some fundamental, legitimate grievances that fuel this movement. That it's true for al-Qaeda, you know, the issue of Palestine is just an abstract symbol to rally around. It's true that, you know, for the 19 hijackers who brought those towers down, the idea of withdrawing American troops from the Middle East was just words. They thought that this would bring more troops to the Middle East. That's what they
hoped.
Right,
that's what they wanted.
But it's also true that for the audience of those acts of terror, the people that those acts were meant for, these theatrical displays of public violence, that these are legitimate grievances and they have to be addressed. And until we fundamentally change the way that we do business in that region, we are going to continue to deal with these problems, these movements. So we've got the rhetoric part down. We've sort of laid out the road, but it's going to require actually walking on this road. And thus far, we haven't done anything. Well, I mean, honestly, let's be perfectly frank here.
Well, it's only been 100 days. 100 days.
It's true. It's only been 100 days. They've got some other, like, what do you call
they've
it?
They've had some other problems.
Global economic collapse. Yeah. By the way, you guys remember the good old days when all we had to worry about was two wars and global terror? good days for selling books, by the way, those days.
this is still okay. You're still okay.
But we haven't seen any actions yet from this administration. None at all. So, you know,
have liked to have seen this fast?
Well,
I'm just curious.
First of all,
and let's talk to the audience.
Okay, so two very quick things that are really easy to do. The first is let's get a statement from Obama saying very clearly that his sole goal in Israel-Palestine is a two-state solution, and he will not abide for any discussion that veers from that framework. No discussion at all. So there isn't sort of like, let's talk about issues that we've got in mind with Likud or Netanyahu. No. Right, you either accept a two-state solution or you don't. That's what we said
to
Hamas.
That's for after the second inauguration, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's... The second thing, and this is like a major game changer, and it talk about low-lying fruit, it's Syria. You know, Syria has a government that has been on its knees begging the United States to please, please talk to it. We don't want to be friends with Iran anymore. Syria is that sort of, you know, the kind of the new kid in school who gets picked up by, you know, the sort of like the nerd the first day and suddenly realizes, oh man, is this my crowd now? Oh man. And then like, you know, the jock walks in and says, hey, dude, Syria, you want to hang out at my lunch table? You can if you want to, but, you know, you have to do A, B, and C. And Syria's like, I will definitely do A, B, and C. Just name it. I'll do it. I want to hang out at the jock's table. And then we just sort of ignored it. Syria is dying for a peace treaty with Israel. Netanyahu will take it. Syria is ready to sort of bend over, basically.
But aren't there conversations going on? I got the impression from the New York Times piece today on Hamas that one of the things Michal is reacting to is low-level conversations with the Syrians
about
eating at the same lunch table.
We have been for some time having some very low level secret negotiations with Syria.
Very
That's
secret,
not what it
so
takes.
Secret that we know about them here at the library.
So
tonight.
So secret, so secret that it takes Cy Hirsch to tell us about them. This has to be a public event. I mean, we need you know Hillary Clinton to show up in Damascus with arms wide open. Syria is dying for it. It's so easy. It will take no effort on our part. But
by the way, Michelle had some things to say about Hillary Clinton. He said, "I like the way Obama is speaking, but Hillary Clinton sounds like the old administration."
That's her function.
Yeah, that's her function.
That's her function. Yeah,
the conserving, moderating. Right.
That's right.
All right, let's have some questions from the audience. That's what we really want here. Yes, this man in front, because I see him first. And then they bring you the microphone.
As Obama's thesis advisor, perhaps, are there any specific policies or actions that Obama could possibly take to move us from fighting a war with warriors to, say, a police action against criminals? Or are we has Bush led us into quicksand that we never can get out of?
Specifically, yes. And there are some things that he is doing. And key to that, of course, is part of our Afghanistan strategy. Now, I'm not sure about the strategy. I'm not going to sit here and say it's a good one, or whether it's going to work. But fundamental to that strategy is that 99% of those who call themselves Taliban are more than willing to lay down their guns for a few bucks and, you know, the promise of some sort of semi-autonomy. And so a decision has been made by this administration to divide those that can be talked to and those that can't be talked to. This administration is not stupid. They know that you can't talk to al-Qaeda. There's nothing to talk about. The only response to these militants is the military response or the police response. They have to be rooted out. They have to be destroyed or brought to justice. There's no other option. But to sort of conflate all of these groups around al-Qaeda with al-Qaeda is a strategic blunder that has created precisely this cosmic war sense that has brought, you know, this sort of good versus evil clash of civilizations over the future of human civilization as we know it that we have been fighting thus far. So that's a very real fundamental thing that they have set out. Again, they haven't done it yet,
right?
But they have set out, as you know, to do that. The other thing is a little less popular is to recognize that, you know, Bush was right about this idea of political participation. It does have the power to moderate radical tendencies. It always has. It's proven over and over again in Malaysia and Indonesia, in Egypt, in Turkey, in
Lebanon for a while.
Especially in Lebanon. I mean, Hezbollah has completely reframed itself as a political organization. Let me step back for a moment here. I hate doing that. I was like, these 30-minute answers to
right, and remember, other people have questions.
Yes, okay, very quickly. It's sort of the common wisdom is that the war between Israel and Hamas, you know, in December was the direct result of Bush's stupid democracy promotion. See how stupid he was? He pressed for elections. He pressed for democracy.
Hamas.
They elected Hamas. And the result of that was this horrible war between Hamas and Israel. There's the lesson to be learned about, you know, the danger of promoting democracy in the region. Wrong. The lesson to be learned about democracy in the region is that during the 30 days of bombardment that Israel punished Gaza with, not a single missile flew into Israel from Hezbollah, not one. They completely and totally sat the fight out, not just militarily, but even rhetorically. Why? Because there are elections happening in Lebanon, and Hezbollah is a political party now, and it wanted to do as well as we all think it's going to do. And it was not about to destroy its chances by opening up a new front, you know, to this war at a time in which Lebanon is dealing with these profound economic consequences of the previous war. They did what any smart politician would do. They thought about their professional future. That's what democracy can do. So done right, it is the right answer. It's just we didn't really do it right. So I would sort of hope that Obama recognizes this and continues to push for greater political freedoms and political participation.
Let's see. This lady in the back, right in front of you, there.
As a writer and someone who is very articulate and understands the religion, have you thought about sitting down and writing a letter to Hillary Clinton and to Obama outlining what you have told us tonight?
Dear Hillary,
weren't you talking to them already recently?
I've done a lot of work with various groups, the Department of Homeland Security and Counterterrorism and the State Department. I have not heard a peep from the Obama administration, and that's partly because I worked for Hillary's campaign.
I'm sure they've heard peeps.
Oh yeah, no, they yes.
Peeps galore.
Yeah. I mean, I know the people involved. But the truth of the matter is Amy's right. I mean, it's been 104 days. I was in D.C. and had a conversation with a couple of people in Obama's, the transition team that essentially became the permanent, you know, team of Team Obama. And they were telling me they don't even know where their desks are yet, you know, because I was saying, you know, have you guys done this and can I come here and can I do that? And they're like, we don't even, honestly, we have no idea where the desks are. We don't know where the coffee maker is. We don't know anything right now. It's a total jumble of confusion. So, hopefully that'll happen, but it hasn't happened yet.
Do you know if the Middle Eastern desks in the State Department are changing hands? I know that Bush sort of purged a lot of the Arabist specialists.
Yeah.
Do you know at all what's happening there?
Well, what I do know is that Obama fired every single ambassador, everyone, in every country. Right now, we don't have a single ambassador, actually, in any country. He's yet to actually assign any.
I keep saying I'm available for Haiti, but nobody.
Yeah. Oh. I think you can have Haiti.
No, I'm not sure.
No, I'm just kidding. No. Lovely country, please. Yes, lovely country. Just ignore the open sewers. It's true. So, I mean, they have done, I mean, Obama sort of came in and said, I'm just going to clean house, you know, forget it. Everybody is gone.
So maybe it is changing.
So quickly. I think they are doing that in that process, yeah.
Let's have someone else in the audience. You, with the beard and the stripes. You, very much. Identity check, that's you.
Beard and the stripes.
Given that we take for granted that there's some sincerity in our government in helping to combat the war against women by the Taliban, what could we constructively do in that area?
Yeah, this is another thing that I have to say that I don't give passing grades to for the Obama administration, because conspicuously absent from the great rollout of the Afghanistan strategy was anything that had to do with civil society or with democracy. In fact, the word democracy was never used. I understand this. I understand that that term has been sullied by the Bush administration. I understand that in large parts of the world, it's essentially a euphemism for regime change, that it's synonymous with hypocrisy. I get that. But it's a real issue. It's a real aspiration. And, you know, we have not poured all of this effort into Afghanistan to sort of allow it to kind of be what it was, you know, in the past, as long as it's not our problem anymore. This is the long war. It's not Iraq. This is the war that we're going to be in for the next 20 years. And we have a commitment. I had this conversation at a dinner party at Amy's house.
I remember.
Yes. And the consensus around my half of the table was that Americans don't give a damn about Afghanistan. And, you know, really, we don't care. So what if it's Talibanized? I mean, honestly, we've stopped caring. I don't know if that's true. I hope it's not true, because we owe that country something. We've made a set of promises to that nation. And it's not about, you know, Afghanistan anymore. It's about us. It's about who we are. It's about what we stand for. I'm not sure. I don't know what Obama's plan is. There was this idea that there was going to be an 80-20 split in the money that goes to Afghanistan, where 80% is going to be for civil infrastructure and 20% was for the military. But then the budget came out and it was actually flipped. So 80% for the military and 20% for civil infrastructure. Again, it's hard, 104 days, you know, I'm not sure. The strategy has been written, but it's not in place yet. And already, by the way, people in the administration themselves have started to question it, because, you know, when we put the strategy in place, there was a functioning government in Pakistan. And now the whole AFPAC idea, this notion of treating Afghanistan and Pakistan like a single foreign policy unit, which is the foundation of our strategy in that region, seems a little bit mistaken now, and so we don't really know where we're going with it. But no, I have to say that is one of my major disappointments so far in this administration.
The lady in maroon up there.
Thanks. Currently, the government in Pakistan has been getting increasing flack for the way it's been handling the internal conflict that's going on there that I guess some have described as an Islamic insurgency, but I've seen press reports that indicate that some American policymakers, military advisors, and the like would like to see Pakistan direct more military efforts against the people who are combating it. At the same time, I've seen reports that the Pakistanis are upset with the Americans for our use of the unmanned drones and the air attacks that in some cases tragically have killed innocent civilians. And so I'm just curious to know how you would advise either the government of Pakistan or the U.S. government to deal with the situation.
Well, I think that it is true that the whole sort of military philosophy in Pakistan is completely backwards. I mean, honestly, why are there hundreds of thousands of Pakistani troops, stationed along the border of India and Pakistan? Do they really think that India is about to invade at any minute? I mean, is that honestly what they believe? I mean, I know that there is this sort of Cold War mentality in that region, and that there is this sort of sense that the real enemy is really India, and for India, the real enemy is really Pakistan. But you know, in the meantime, while you're on this sort of southern border doing nothing, your entire government is being destabilized by a force coming from the north. I'm glad that the military has finally understood this and that they have begun to redeploy its troops and they have begun to engage these militants and push them back into the Swat Valley. It's a good start. I mean, hopefully that will actually continue and be successful. It's hard to say. The military in Pakistan is not what it used to be. But I will say this one thing that I think is very important about Pakistan is that, yes, it's got a totally inept and completely corrupt government. Yes, it's on the verge of destabilization. But there is zero chance, and I mean zero chance, of the Talibanization of Pakistan. Because the fact of the matter is that no matter who's in charge of Pakistan, the military's in charge of Pakistan. And long before there's any idea that these militants are going to sort of take over Islamabad, the military will take over and just kill everybody, like they have done in many, many times in the past. We talk, and especially the nuclear issue, this idea that, I mean, sometimes if you read the American press, you get the sense that, you know, there are these, like, wide open fields with these, you know, nuclear bombs and like a chain link fence and, you know, bin Laden on the other side going, you know, it's ridiculous. I mean, these first of all, they're dismantled and they're under military protection. But, you know, the notion that somehow this is going to become, you know, Afghanistan with nukes is just ridiculous. It's impossible. Now, I'm not saying that it's good that Pakistan is looking at another military dictatorship. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that that's much more likely than, you know, the sort of Talibanization of that country.
Because they don't give up their power for the Taliban.
No. Right. No.
We have time for one more question, I'm afraid.
Is it going to be?
It's going to be the man in the white shirt. Sorry to everyone else. I feel
you.
Really bad.
What's your question?
This is actually a question from my cousin in Boston, and he's at UMass, and he's asking him his view on Sufi elements and its ability to infiltrate fundamentalism. Pakistan as a prime example. Cite BBC's article if you can. Should we, as American Muslims, embrace Sufism as a friendlier, lighter side of Islam, or is that too apologetic?
You didn't expect that one.
Yeah, and you know what? We're not going to end on that question.
Okay, we're going to end on
It's a good question, and, you know, as, you know, a Sufi myself, I would say, yeah, let's do it. Let's take over. Anyway, I'll just leave it at that. Tell your friend to email me.
This guy. This guy. I've long had my eye on him.
Thanks. On Sunday night, Al Jazeera released a tape of fundamentalist Christian soldiers in Bagram Air Base. And the head chaplain for Afghanistan was talking about singing the hound of heaven on these unwashed hordes. Would you talk about the roadblock I see down the way, that there is a significant component in the United States military establishment which is dedicated to the crusade?
Now, that's a good question to end on. Yeah, I mean, a full quarter of my book is about the rabid evangelization of our armed forces. This is a group that has consciously, deliberately laid out a strategy for taking over America's military forces, and they have put that strategy into place. They are centered at the Air Force Academy, which has been repeatedly cited for violations of the Constitution. This is an academy in which cadets themselves have openly said that if you don't accept Jesus, you have no chance of succeeding in this academy. This is an academy that the head of Campus Crusade for Christ, that has a an office in the heart of the Air Force Academy, was caught in a video extolling their services there, saying that his mission at the Air Force Academy is to create, quote, government-trained missionaries. Not soldiers, government-trained missionaries. And in fact, this idea of a missionary military has gone to the very highest levels of our military. In the Pentagon itself is something called the Christian Embassy, which is precisely this evangelical organization whose founding charter states that what they want to do is convert as many high-ranking military people as possible, because that's how you bring the message to cadets. If your, you know, senior officer says, you know, accept Jesus in your heart before we go out to this war, you accept Jesus in your heart before this happens. And this isn't just me talking. I'm part of an organization called the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. I definitely recommend all of you to check it out. It's called militaryreligiousfreedom.org. If you see the cover story on this month's Harper's Magazine, Jeff Charlotte has done a wonderful job.
So good on this.
Yeah, it's an article called Jesus Killed Muhammad.
Shouldn't these be purged, though, from the military?
Far from being purged, they have been, under the Obama administration, elevated. So David Gergen. Starts with a G, ends with an N.
What does he do for a living?
Well, now he's the Secretary of the Army.
Ah.
And this is a man who has repeatedly, at numerous military functions, described the war in Iraq as a war between Christianity and Islam. Our troops on the ground in Iraq, and you have to understand the reason why this is so prevalent and why there's so much resources are being pumped into it, is that our military is today engaged in countries in which missionaries are not allowed. You know, if you're a Christian missionary, you can't go to Iraq or to Afghanistan and preach. But if you have a soldier's uniform on, then you can. And so these soldiers are being given New Testaments in Arabic. They're being given comic books,
leaflets,
coins, and in full uniform, riding in tanks, they're going out and they're evangelizing to the population. Now, if... this is the whole issue here, right? Is that
right on the
these
ground.
Are people? There's a group out there that's trying to convince the Muslim world that we're engaged in a crusade, that this is a cosmic battle between the forces of Islam and Christianity, that this is, you know, a heavenly contest between the forces of good and evil, and we've got soldiers, generals, you know, who are using the same language and who are extolling, you know, the military to go out there and think of these conflicts in the same way. I mean, I don't have to tell you how disastrous this is. This is a recipe for Armageddon.
Living up to their expectations.
But of course, that's precisely the point, is that what they want is Armageddon. So this is the focal point of end time events, to quote Tim LaHaye. You know, it's a horrifying situation, and we really need to root it out. I was at the Air Force Academy recently after a report came out, and after the Air Force Academy was supposedly purged, and, you know, the head of the academy was fired. I was there to give a speech about this, and it was shocking the way that people. I mean, these kids in cadet uniform standing up and saying, you know, it's my religious freedom. I can proselytize. It's my freedom, you know, as an American. And what's shocking about that is that here is somebody who has gone through 4 years of military academy and nobody has told them that he has no freedoms. No. You put on that uniform so that I have freedom of religion. You don't have freedom of religion. I have freedom of speech. You don't have freedom of speech. You put on that uniform, you don't have the freedoms that I have anymore. It's called defending the Constitution. So it's not what's shocking to me is that no one's told them this. No one's actually sat down and said to them, you're not allowed to do this. So this is an insidious movement, and it's enormously successful. And hopefully there'll be a brighter light shined on it. And on that note...
Yeah, on that note, thank you so much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.